Welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe today. Joe Kirk, hello.
Hello.
Double trouble again. It was a good session. You know, we really delved into some topics today rather than floating over a lot as, you know, it's just common fashion with he who shall not be named. No, I'm joking. We're all the same for it. But it was a really good session regardless. What did we talk about, Joe? Tell me more.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed that. Because you, like you say, normally there's that much that we just fly through about 30 stories and we never really delve too deep into them. So this time I think we went at a little bit of a slower pace and kind of you know, delved into three or more interesting topics such as facial recognition. We delved quite nice into that because there was three or four stories in the news, and they linked quite nicely, didn't they, around bias and how do you kind of you know, mitigate risks around you know, bias and AI. And then we kind of unpicked around ICO published some new guidance, didn't they, around data sharing regarding mental health emergencies as well. So there was one more. The conservative stuff as well.
Yeah, the True Blue app, is it? So I delved into that one a little bit around what lawful basis might have been appropriate should that have gone ahead. Might have gone over a few people's heads as I drew up the Data Protection Act, yeah. Which is a, you know, common occurrence when you have to delve into that. But there was a lot of input from the chat again. Some difficult to keep up with, Joe.
Yeah, it is hard, yeah. When there's two of you, isn't it?
Yeah. You exposed yourself with your knowledge of case law.
Oh well, yeah. I don't come from a legal background, so I don't. if it's like 40 pages, I don't want to read it.
That's our job.
I mean,
honestly,
I still do
don't
it.
Let Phil hear this.
I still do it. I just don't enjoy it. It's the
a good
part
job
of the work
you,
I don't enjoy.
It's the good job you're in account management now. Otherwise, Phil would have your neck.
Yeah.
No, you just still do a good job regardless somehow.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, we'll let you get into the main session anyway. We hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back next week with a guest speaker, Rebecca Balabaco. So stay tuned for that one. Thank you.
Slightly unorthodox, to say the least. I feel like I say that every week when I'm on this and you ask me how my week is, because no week's really the same at DPP. But on Tuesday, I changed roles. So I am no longer on the support desk at DPP. I am now working alongside yourself in account management. So yeah, it's been a slight adjustment to my usual working week at work, but it's been rather enjoyable. It's quite nice being back in the sales office with you, Rob, and Miles. It's been good. It's been enjoyable. It's nice having. I'm just going through the process now of contacting all my accounts to set up an introductory call. So if you're waiting for me to respond to you, I apologize. I am getting round to it. It's just it's very busy. I keep getting pulled in different directions. I'm still having to do a little bit of help on the support desk as well. So time is rapidly going every day. But yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying it so far. So yeah, it's been a good week.
Yeah, it's nice to see that all the things that you used to give me grief for, you now understand.
Yes. So, just a little bit.
Yeah. And it will continue.
I'm sure. Yeah. How about you? How's your week been?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been to be honest, it's been hard readjusting just for the fact that I had a week off last week. It was just nonstop from London to Morocco to my birthday. So it was a good week.
Yes, I forgot. Yeah. We've not had one of these, have we, since then?
No.
Yeah, we went out, didn't we, on Sunday to celebrate your birthday.
Yeah.
How was your holiday?
Oh, it was really good. Morocco. I went to Marrakesh. It was amazing. It's just a different world. I was walking around, I bought these like Moroccan pants, and as I was walking around, all I heard in my head was like Arabian Nights. I was just thinking I was in Aladdin or something, but yeah, it was really good anyway. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah, Morocco looks beautiful.
Oh, it's unbelievable. But yeah, coming back to work has been a bit of a shock, to be fair. I've not had a significant amount of time off in a long time now. I think I'm back into the swing of things. I went on site to visit a customer yesterday, which was fun, in Manchester. Got treated to a meal out as well, which I keep thinking about because it was really nice.
That's right up your street, isn't it?
I know. You'll have that to come now.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah. So have you seen anything in the news anyway? It's been a couple of weeks, so there's plenty of stuff, isn't there?
There is plenty of stuff, and quite a lot that I want to unpick on here, actually. One of the topics is facial recognition. I think there's quite a few news pieces in that, and I kind of want to start around the Amazon fine. I think it was back in January earlier this year that the CNIL, the French regulator, fined Amazon $34.58 million, to be exact, for setting up a system to monitor employee activity and performance. The CNIL stated that this was considered to be excessively intrusive surveillance system, and Amazon has actually lodged an appeal for this fine. So I thought that was quite interesting. You know, it would be very, we'd have to keep tabs on that. They said that they strongly disagree with the CNIL's conclusions, which are factually incorrect, and we have filed an appeal before the Council of State, Amazon said in an emailed response to Reuters. I'm not sure if you're aware of what the CNIL kind of like, where they crossed the line. Obviously, I know they said excessively intrusive, but I'm not sure if you've heard of the, have you heard of like the implications of the system as to why they think it's excessively intrusive?
So from memory, I think, so it was barcode scanners, wasn't it, that they were monitoring staff through. So I think they were monitoring staff activity alongside, you know, other reasons why they would need those scanners. And it was found to be really intrusive because it could cause, you know, it could lead to distress of individuals and potentially, you know, in a worst case scenario, maybe unfair dismissals. I think there was issues around transparency as well, with particularly temporary staff and maybe volunteers if they have volunteers, but you know, that level anyway. I don't think they were provided with proper privacy information, so I'm not sure the breakdown of why they came to €32 million as a fine. It's a hefty fine, like
I was gonna say I imagine it's down to the amount of data subjects that will be impacted. I guess if it's across all of France, Amazon's departments, you'd think it'd probably be a fair few thousand.
Yeah.
In terms of the way it's tracking, obviously you mentioned handheld barcode scanners. Is the whole point of it then around like the tracking of performance in terms of the amount of things that you like scan?
Potentially.
Because when I worked at Amazon, I actually worked at Amazon during COVID. I had an 8-week temp job there, and I was a picker, so my job was that like a little robot would come and bring like a shelf. And I'd like, it would highlight the bin of where the item was. I'd have to pull it out, scan it and put it in the tote, hit the tote, and then the next one would come. And I was obviously tracked for performance in terms of I had like a specific thing. It registered how many items I'd scanned. And I think I had to hit 360 in an hour.
Mm.
So that works out, equates to like one every 6 seconds. Mm. So as an organization, are you then required to inform data subjects that obviously you're going to be tracked, or I guess would that be as part of the employee privacy policy as you become
both, I'd say both really, but I think on the face of it that's not too bad. I mean, we have it, you know, in the sales team, the new business sales team here, that you've got to make a certain amount of calls a day, that kind of thing. I presume, you know, I'm just guessing here to be fair, but I presume that if they'd have had 10 minutes of, you know, they've gone to the toilet and they've not scanned anything in that time, then they're getting questioned about it. There's probably been a lot of micromanaging around it that's gone a bit too far, I presume, especially for a fine that hefty. But
yeah, maybe. I'm just trying to wrap my head around why this instance is any different to kind of, you know, when I was there, and they're just, you know, they're tracking through the system of how many things are scanned. you know, it reflects my performance at work. I don't, I'm just trying to wrap my head around why this is any different and why it's, and why they can all see it as excessively intrusive, sorry.
I guess if you weren't aware of your privacy rights at the time, then maybe you thought
about that.
Maybe there's a claim there, Joe.
that is true. I wasn't aware of, you know, like privacy. Honestly, I knew I was being tracked in terms of performance, but I guess I didn't really see the consequences of doing so. Obviously, in terms of, like you said, like the micromanagement, and obviously that can cause quite a bit of stress, you know, having like the thought of someone looking over you. So, yeah, you are absolutely right. And I try to cast my mind back. I don't think I received an employee privacy policy. I mean, I probably
did.
No, I probably wouldn't have read it. I mean, who does, you know, the general public, who does read privacy policies?
On a day to day.
5% people, you think, maybe even less.
I reckon it's more so when there's a need to read it. You know, it's important make sure that information's there if somebody does want to, you know, understand further. You do get people, obviously, probably most of us on this call now, that, you know, that will look for further into these things because it's in our interest. But generally, as you say, it's not going to be that many, you know, when they imagine all the privacy policies that they're faced with on a day-to-day with signing up to new things. Maybe it's more likely within, you know, an employment situation, but yeah. Janine said in the chat, we had an advice note. They had an advice note from us on something very similar very recently that said similar to what the report said. So that's good to know, at least.
Oh, so
thank
our,
you for
our
that advertising.
our findings were matched with that of the canal. Is that the gist of it? Yes. Excellent. Yeah. That's what we like to hear, Janine. Thanks for that, Janine.
Janine's not being paid for this, by the way.
Janine's a paid actor.
It's funny that you brought up Amazon, to be fair, because I was reading a blog on facial recognition and the risks around it, you know, in relation to discrimination. there was a reference to Amazon from back in 2018 about I think they developed this model that was intended to screen resumes. And we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, David and me, and he got involved, but I can't remember for the life of me what that was in relation to, because we just go through so many news pieces. But in this particular instance anyway, so they had to basically get rid of this this model, this piece of software, because it brought back really biased results. So screened out resumes that contain the word women or women associated colleges, because the system had learned that prior candidates deemed successful were predominantly male. Now, past hiring practices and centuries of denying women the right to education, coupled with challenges, you know, faced on higher education and so on, made it especially male dominated. So all of these things that come into play were then, you know, affecting the decision of this AI model, which is obviously what happens, what we've seen happen quite often, really, you know, in the new era of AI, and, you know, it's decision-based protocols. So yeah, it's something, it's a risk, it's something to look into, and isn't it, it's
absolutely a risk. And it actually, that it's funny that you say that, because it links quite nicely to a news story that I saw as I was, you know, doing a little bit of prep for the podcast. And it was regarding an Uber Eats driver over face scan bias case. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but the gist of it is that a black Uber Eats driver has received a payout after racially discriminatory facial recognition checks prevented him accessing the app to secure work. So when the gentleman started working in November 2019, its app did not regularly ask him to send selfies in order to register for jobs, but the Microsoft-powered Uber Eats app increased these verification checks. And in 2021, it said after careful consideration, his account would be removed due to continued mismatches. And an Uber representative said that our real-time ID check is designed to keep everyone who uses our app safe and includes robust human review to make sure that we're not making decisions about someone's livelihood in a vacuum without oversight. And I think that from them just kind of raised some alarms to me, really. You know, he stated there that they have robust human reviews, and yet still somebody was racially profiled, you know, and obviously it's linked to him not being able to get work, which obviously has consequences. You know, if he's got rent to hit, you know, that could have some serious implications, can't it, in the process of something AI doesn't recognize you, you're not able to get a job. That has some serious consequences for you as a person, you know, and like in terms of your livelihood. You can't earn money, so you can't go out, you can't pay your rent that you're due, your credit score will be affected. That could lead to stress, you know. So I think the concerning bit about me here, though, is that with something like this, you know, it's obviously considered high risk. I'd say I think this meets the conditions of Article 35 of the UK GDPR. Therefore, a DPIA would be required. You'd think they'd have carried a DPIA out. And as part of the DPIA, it would identify the risk of someone being incorrectly recognised and the risk of racial discrimination. And they've even had measures in place to mitigate those risks through robust human review. And yet they've still failed to mitigate that risk. So it kind of just, I think it's a good example of, although you might have, you know, the correct measures in place, such as a DPIA, if you're not actually successful, if you're, what's the word I'm looking, if your execution at mitigating that risk is poor, then, you know, the process in itself is still a risk. And I just, do you get what I'm trying to say? It just baffles my mind a little bit that as to how they've missed such a glaringly obvious, you know, risk.
So, I think, I suppose, maybe you have to take a step back and think who are the people, not to point any fingers or anything, but who are the people behind in these situations, behind the AI, you know, installing the AI, and what are they actually considering as part of this? Is, did this even come into question? I suppose it's a new, you know, it's completely new for all of us, really, and people are playing with it. It's a new toy AI in a lot of ways, and we're coming across these mistakes as we go along, but you know, there's more and more examples cropping up, and it's moving forward. We need to put measures in place to make sure that we're directly identifying these risks and putting in appropriate measures to mitigate them. I'd really like to know what, you know, what risks they'd raised and thought of before this, and whether that even came into question, to be honest. But if it did come into question, and they put in, you know, measures to mitigate, then how do you do better than that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a shame that they're not a private they're not a public company, isn't it? Because it would have been quite interesting to request a DPIA and have a look at, you know, what they've done. So it's a good question as to how, you know, how do you kind of mitigate the risk of bias in terms of facial recognition. And facial recognition's a hot topic, actually, isn't it? It's been in the news quite a lot. It's obviously, I know it's a form, you call it a form of AI. But I don't know if you saw that facial recognition by UK law enforcement's raising concerns for privacy groups. So obviously, I think we've spoken on here, haven't we, quite a bit recently about the Met's use of facial recognition for what it calls precision policing based on bespoke watch lists has resulted in 17 arrests, leading critics to level accusations of Orwellian surveillance tactics. Is that the right? Is that how I'm saying that correctly? Yeah. Have you seen that story?
1984. I mean, again, it's what we're saying, isn't it? How do you mitigate against AI bias? And even still, in more in this sense, is it proportionate to collect information on all or any passing individuals to see it? You know, they say they delete the information straight away. Is that proportionate? Is that sufficient? I don't know. It doesn't feel right. I don't know.
Also, the deleting of the data, if it doesn't make a match, I presume is an automated decision, right? You know, and then obviously would that not open up other avenues of concerns in terms of, you know, from a privacy perspective?
Yeah, I think automated decision making, you're testing me here.
So I'm not that well.
I've not looked into it in a little while.
But obviously, it's I'm sure you have to have human intervention of some sort, don't you? Or if you don't, then there's
It's
things that you have to put in place.
law enforcement, though, isn't it? And the GDPR
True.
doesn't
Yes.
apply to law enforcement. That's why I'm a little bit skewy on
Yeah, no, that's fair. Maybe we should park this conversation and do a little bit of reading and come back to you on that.
Yeah.
Unless anyone in the chat's listening is
To be
like,
continued.
this is the answer. Please unmute and
Yeah.
guide me. This is where we need Phil.
Yeah.
And moments
To
like
be
this.
fair, I feel like Phil would be the exact same. He'll give us the answer and then say, oh, but I don't know. But yeah, on that question, how do you mitigate against AI bias? I've given this some thought, and at first I didn't know, to be honest, because it's really deep rooted in society. But obviously on an individual level, like individual as in terms of like individual organizational level, what measures could you put in place? That, you know, you talk about DPIAs and measures to mitigate risks. And I was thinking, you talk about human intervention as well. If maybe one approach would be to have a diverse workforce that would be, or at least group of people within your workforce that could be responsible for actually, you know, checking this AI and
yeah.
providing some different opinions as well. Rebecca's said in the chat, automated decision making will be interesting with the DPDI bill and its reframing of this, especially as it's currently missing clauses that align with the EU Act to protect data subjects from such risks around the use of AI. Yeah.
It's a really good point. And I guess that kind of strengthens our worries in terms of, you know, the UK's loss of adequacy with AI being such, you know, an emerging innovative idea. Missing clauses in our new bill that doesn't align with the new EU AI Act surely doesn't mean that the UK is deemed to be given essentially equivalent levels of data protection to that of the EU GDPR. So yeah, no, that's really interesting, Rebecca. Thanks for raising that.
Yeah.
Just going back to facial recognition before we move on, and kind of while we're on the conversation of it being used in, you know, the police force. I saw a news piece regarding a report from the Alan Turing Institute Centre of Emerging Technology and Security, a bit of a mouthful, and the future of biometric technology for UK law enforcement and policing. And the report highlighted the need for updated regulatory measures to support the responsible use and restrictions of such systems. And the report indicates that in the next 5 to 10 years, the availability of biometric systems and data will expand significantly, moving beyond the prevailing purposes of identifying individuals. The report stated that while most of the UK public, 60%, is comfortable with the benefits biometrics could provide to identify criminal suspects in a crowd, this figure fell to 29%, where biometric data is used to determine if someone is telling the truth. Still, more than half, 53% of respondents believe that the benefits of biometrics outweigh the concerns, compared with 24% who thought the concerns outweighed the benefits. Respondents are more likely to trust the use of biometric systems by public sector organisations such as the police force, which was 79%, and the NHS 66%, as opposed to private companies at 42% and retailers at 38%.
I'm going to copy and paste that and put that into the chat.
Sorry, I know how to do a poll. I figured it out.
No, but either way, I'm going to copy and paste and put it into the chat, because I want people to be able to look over this, because
okay.
I just don't believe it, to be honest. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
It just, John, when you.
Sorry,
hold on. Yeah, make a poll, please. But I'm going to let people.
It's bloody disappeared. Where's it gone?
Have another look over this.
More apps. It was in apps. And I searched poll. And it's not there. Why is it not there?
Oh,
no.
Oh, you know
God,
what? I told you not to do this.
Aren't we useless? Anyone knows I had to do a poll, please let us know. Oh, hang on. Oh, I've got it.
Right,
it.
Okay.
Sorry, guys. Yeah.
So, as Joe was saying.
Here we go.
60% of the UK is comfortable with the benefits biometrics could provide to identify criminal suspects in a crowd. This figure fell to 29%. Now, I understand this in, you know, in large events, especially with events of the past, and you know, it's quite a concern. Even, you know, people do get concerned when I don't know, say if there was a final a Wembley or something like that, I don't know, or a massive concert happening, people are concerned of the risk posed because of, you know, previous attacks. But at the same time, I don't feel like there's a general trust in police use of facial recognition. So I want to get, yeah, we want to get your opinions on this. I'm not going to vote myself.
I accidentally put yes. So results are skewed.
You put yes.
I put yes. It is anonymous, guys. Names are not recorded. Yeah. Results are shared, however. Just if you're worrying about the privacy implications of that. So what are the results? Six people of seven minus myself. Take one off for me. 22%. Nine people have said that unsure or maybe if additional safeguards are in place.
Still going up.
It is. We'll give it a moment or two. There is 75 people in here, Jasmine.
I know, it's a good turnout for Easter holidays. So.
Easter holidays.
Happy with that.
Don't know why I'm so surprised. So we got 47 responses. Tell you what, should we crack on and we can always come back, can't we, towards the end?
Yeah.
As people vote and think. Actually, just before we move on. Something quite interesting would have aligned quite nicely to last week's session. I have come across keeling schedules for the DPDI bill, the Data Protection Act 2018, and the PECA as well. So I'm just going to pop those in the chat because they are very useful. If anyone wants to have a read, I think it's John Baines on LinkedIn that found those.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
A shout out to him.
So David said there's probably a general lack of trust in police doing anything, never mind the use of technology. And this is exactly what I was thinking. You know, the issues around, generally, I think people are quite concerned about the way that the world's going in terms of Orwellian, you know, Big Brother, kind of just very much data. I don't know, just no privacy, basically. And the fact that 60% would feel comfortable with this, I was just really interested to know how the questions were phrased first, and also who was asked. And
yeah.
I just think that these would have a massive effect. I mean, even if so, one of the statistics was still more than half, 53% of respondents believe that the benefits of biometrics outweigh the concerns. Compared with 24% who thought the concerns outweigh the benefits. Now, I was thinking even in that sense how the questions were framed and or the information was framed, because if they were told of, oh, look at all of these benefits of, you know, facial recognition, but there are these concerns, then they're more likely to have these benefits already in the head and then weigh the concerns against the benefits that they've already decided are good. Whereas if it was the other way around, you know, you've got to develop trust. And if you're told of, oh, look at all these risks, but these are the potential benefits, I think the number would come down. So yeah. I don't know. I saw this and I just didn't believe it.
No,
I just thought, absolutely not.
I reiterate your comments there, Jasmine, in terms of the belief. I do want to add that, you know, they're saying that they asked the UK public. Bear in mind that I think the population of the UK is, I think it's like 68 million. They've gone up a little bit more since, you know, the last year or two that I think I might have checked. And 662 members were asked. So I'm not really sure how you can come to the conclusion that the UK public, 60% of the UK public think that they have trust or they're comfortable with police using facial recognition when you've only asked 662. I'm not sure what the percentage of what does that work out as a percentage of
0.01 or 0.01 or something. I don't even know.
It'll be ridiculously small. Small. Yeah, absolutely. And I just, it's, you know, it's a good idea, but I don't think I don't think it's a broad enough pool of people. I mean, just look at our poll. I know we've only asked 53 people, but it's the complete opposite of what they've said. 56% of people said no, whereas they found that 60% are comfortable with it. Now, Vaughan left
what
a comment.
What are our results here?
Our
so
results.
We've got eight, as well as Joe, we've got 18% do have trust in police use of facial recognition. 56% don't, and 24% are unsure, maybe if additional safeguards are in place. And that's on 53 responses, which is probably just about 9% of that study. So, you know, it's not too bad. What were you saying? Sorry, Joe.
No, it's all right. There's just quite a bit of stuff in the chat. Vaughan said, is there an issue trusting the technology or trusting the people who use the data it captures? And then even Miles is paying attention to the podcast. He says guns don't kill people. People do. So I guess that's a funny way of reiterating Vaughan's point.
I think it's both in this instance as well. I think people are using technology that's too powerful that they know how to use. So, but also the way it's configured, I suppose it's the people behind it at the same time, isn't it? It's how it's configured in the first place. Maybe not as with facial recognition as well, definitely. You know, we were just talking about bias, but then also how that is then used following up. So it's all, you know, all fun.
It is. It is, and it's why we love doing it so much. Have you seen anything else in the news?
Just before we move on, to go back to the chat. So Steph said, interesting phrases used here that indicate the fact this sounds wrong, i.e. is the data collected or is it captured? And Owen said, surely most concerned with biometrics are those not wanting to be caught. I don't know what you mean. There just needs to be safeguards to ensure it is used correctly.
I do think there will be benefits of it, but I think Owen is right. There does need to be additional safeguards. So I don't feel bad for that.
I think that's where the concern lies, though. I mean, yeah, if you're not doing anything wrong, then, you know, theoretically, you've got nothing to worry about. But then going back to that Uber driver who lost his job, you know, unfairly, then I think how common that will be is going to be a massive battle if it's not already, to be honest. I think it probably already is.
And also, if you've carried out a DPA on processing such as facial recognition and you've identified the risk and you're still not mitigating the risk, you shouldn't be doing the processing because you're not complying with the UK GDPR, are you? So we're saying here that, you know, there does need to be additional safeguards, and I absolutely agree, but we're kind of past the point of that where people are using it and there's not additional safeguards in play, and it's, you know, it's causing quite big difficulties in people's lives, such as this Uber driver. In this, the case of the Uber driver, Steph's just left a comment saying Roe v. Wade in US. I'm not sure if you know that. That, Jasmine, that doesn't ring any bells to me. I'm not one for case law. But
you can't be admitting that, Joe. Come on.
I know stuff about friends and stuff, but
stop talking. So I just wanted to touch on James's point here. So he said, you are polling somewhat informed people, though perhaps there's an explanation to the results that we brought back, which is also very true. I would be interested to know what demographics. Yeah, does that ring a bell, Joe?
Yes. Yeah.
I'd be interested to know what the demographics of the people asked as well, in terms of location, race, age, especially probably, you know, the older generation, that it'd be completely different. So there's a lot at play. And I suppose we probably need to look into, you know, the background of the study itself to see how accurate that really is, because I just refuse.
absolutely. You are right there, Jasmine, in terms of how different it will be depending on like the age and the background of each specific person. So I think for it to be considered valid, you're going to need a much wider, you know, range of or number of people that have been asked obviously, because then you have more chance of capturing a wider, you know, diversity background, looking at all sorts of things as opposed to just 600 people. So yeah, that's, I don't know if anyone wants to take lead on that and ask the nation. I don't know who's got the most followers on LinkedIn. It's probably Miles, isn't it? To ask people.
Yeah, true, actually.
Okay, moving on then. Have you seen anything else in the news?
So I did actually. I saw that a news piece about the Conservative Party, which I thought was probably quite relevant after we spoke about the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill on the last episode. I suppose the intelligence of the government behind that in relation to their understanding of data protection. So The Guardian has seen documents that reveal that senior Conservative Party officials had planned to take over its entire membership database for commercial venture. It promised to make tens of millions of pounds. It was called the True Blue app. Now, this hasn't gone any further. It's not actually going to be implemented, but the intention was to sell all of their members' data to advertisers on this app to drive revenue. So the purposes of it were to boost donations through digital payments, design bespoke messaging, and maximize voter turnout by directing members to polling stations. The proposed commercialization of members' data concerned some party supporters, and the app would have let companies market products based on a user's location, with the parties taking share of any resulting sales. So I think they would have taken like 75%. A Conservative spokesperson said that the app didn't progress beyond the pitch stage, but emails seen by The Guardian revealed that officials worked through last summer on the project, tailoring the proposed app's content and requesting paperwork, including a draft contract. So I found that quite funny, to be honest. It doesn't surprise me, but it is a massive concern, because obviously information relating to political beliefs is special category data. So yeah. I'd like to know what they've actually considered from a data protection standpoint when they were getting quite excited about this app. And I would like to know as well why it got axed, to be honest.
Yeah. They're all questions that you kind of just ponder, don't you? And I think there's quite a lot to unpack there. And I think for starters, I think that you mentioned there that they could make tens of millions of pounds. So obviously they were going to go through with this at that point. You know, did you think they kind of considered that, you know, does the reward of the 10 million pounds outweigh the potential fine that may be imposed by the ICO if someone was to complain about the processing being unlawful?
Do you think they'd get a fine?
Maybe. I don't think it's lawful. I'm going to unpick why in a minute. But let's say someone reported to the ICO and, you know, it was found to be in breach of some of the principles, let's say, transparent, fair and lawful. And they were to get fined. How likely is the fine? Well, given the ICO didn't even issue a single monetary penalty notice under the GDPR last year, probably unlikely. And if they did, would it be more than 10 million pounds? Probably not. I mean, there are some big fines that are issued by supervisory authorities, but none really ever by the ICO. And I guess for us to then maybe unpick why it might be considered unlawful, I think you'd probably have to look at the lawful basis. What lawful basis would you think they'd probably try relying on? My instinct would be probably legitimate interest as a Article 6 lawful basis, but obviously then you have to provide the data subjects with the option to object to the processing. And I don't think in this instance that the Conservatives will have an overriding legitimate interest to refuse that objection to carry on with the processing.
Yeah. I was, to be honest, I was looking into the Article 9 lawful basis, so special for, you know, processing special category data. I'd be interested in the approach to this and the choice that individuals have in relation to this and how informed they are prior to it. Obviously, it's not going through, but you know, theoretically. But yeah, I was looking at what lawful bases might be available, and off the top of my head, I didn't really think there would be one. But let me just go to ask. I'm going to share my screen here actually, and walk through this.
Is there a would could there be a potential couple of lawful bases under Article 9 then that could apply?
Well,
or are you going down the route of
explicit consent? Let me find
That wouldn't run though, would it? Because it would just be that would just be pointless, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Explicit consent, because as soon as they opt out of the processing, then well, I don't think they'd even opt in, to be honest with you. I don't think you get many at all. It'd just be a complete waste of time, wouldn't it? Explicit consent.
Yeah. So it's a possible one, but not very practical. So, you know, you've got to look to the next ones then. It wouldn't apply to employment, social security and social protection law. You can't argue that it's in the vital interest of individuals. Potentially this one. So processing is carried out in the course. Actually, definitely not. But processing is carried out in the course of its legitimate activities with appropriate safeguards by a foundation, association, or any other not-for-profit body with a political, philosophical, religious, or trade union aim, so obviously political there, on the condition that the processing relates solely to the members or to former members of the body or to persons who have regular contact with it in connection with its purposes, and that the personal data are not disclosed outside the body without the consent of data subjects. So potentially, but again, you need consent to share with, you know, for
third parties.
Yeah, for advertising and commercial purposes. So, you know, falling back on the consent there. It's not manifestly made public, so you can't rely on that. You know, the individual's information. It's not necessary for the establishment, exercise, defence or legal claims, or wherever courts are acting in their judicial capacity. And then I thought maybe substantial public interest. I didn't expect to see one, but I thought, you know what, I'll have a look at the conditions under Schedule 1. Is it? Yeah, Schedule 1.
Schedule 1.
Yeah. So I thought I'll have a little look through just in case to see if there's any conditions that might apply. So, you know, it's obviously not a quality of opportunity or treatment or anything like that. I had a little giggle to myself when I saw protecting the public against dishonesty. Another one, regulated requirements for ethical and lawful acts and dishonesty. Another little chuckle. But then I came to...
What are you trying to infer here, Jasmine?
No comment. I came to Section 22, political parties. So I'm not sure if this one would apply, because I think there is probably an argument there. So the condition is met if the processing is of personal data revealing political opinions, tick, is carried out by a person or organisation included in the register maintained under Section 23 of the Political Parties, Elections and Referendums Act 2000, which it would be, you know, the Conservative Conservative members, I forgot what they're called, the high up ones. processing, so, and then is necessary for the purposes of the person's or organization's political activities. So with this one, you know, if their justification is to raise donations, then there's, you know, probably a bit of an argument there, a loose one, but one that
possibly
might be swayed. It seems still very excessive. But I would presume that this is what they would try to rely on. So there's two exceptions to rely on this, and that's if it's likely to cause substantial damage or substantial distress to a person, which I doubt, if they're informed correctly, I doubt it will be substantial. And then the processing does not meet the condition if, in subparagraph one, an individual who is the data subject is given notice in writing to the controller requiring the controller not to process the data. The notice gave the controller a reasonable period in which to stop processing the data, and the period has ended. So,
that was a really, really useful activity. But I think what you've done there as well is demonstrated how challenging the Data Protection Act is to like read and apply things, and like just, you know, a really useful like, you know, sort of workshop that you've gone through there, Jasmine. But just the Data Protection Act is just, yeah, I can't believe it. It is what it is. Do you know what I'm trying to, like, it's just.
Yeah. You, the thing is, you've got to break each one down and, you know, piece by piece, because you look at this and you're like, it just can go over your head. But if you actually think of it as a step-by-step process, then it makes it slightly easier. With, say, for example, with B here, you know, I presume that this applies. You'd have obviously have to check if it wasn't on a podcast, but but obviously it is the Conservative Party. Yes. It's, I suppose, whether this alone is sufficient to, if it is directly applicable. I would be happy to get people's opinions in the chat as well. I think there's probably an argument here technically, but then if you delve into it with further, you know, with further information, then there's probably some holes in it. I don't know.
I think you're right. I think it'll take quite a bit of justification for that to apply. And I think the third subparagraph of the third point of subparagraph one would probably be the big sticking point. And then obviously you also have to make sure that you've got an appropriate Article 6 lawful basis. And as we said before, you delved into Article 9, not really sure legitimate interest would probably be, I don't think you'd probably, I think you'd struggle a little bit when it comes around to the objection of the process. I mean, you can go ahead, but you just might get quite a bit of.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why they pulled a plug on it.
Well, to be honest, if you think about it, though, lawful basis is one part. You know, you've also got the rest of the principles to consider.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, appropriate measures with any third parties, etc. Could you say that this complies with purpose limitation? Probably not. And you'd probably have to, you know, go around all of the members again and I don't know, inform them or ask for it. And I suppose if they were to sign up to the app, then it's their choice, and then, you know, it's a new process and activity. But there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of implications here. So
there is. Maybe they'd rely on consent, and as you sign up, they'd have, you know, like a tick box. Are you happy for the Conservatives to share your information with third parties for marketing purposes? Is it? I think that was marketing, or, you know, whatever the purpose is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, really interesting stuff, Jasmine, and it would be nice to know why they pulled the plug, but I don't think we'll find that out.
No, definitely not.
Something else that I kind of want to pick on here that's quite interesting. Miles actually sent me this, funny enough. And the ICO has released some guidance around reassuring employers they can share staff data in a mental health emergency. Mm-hmm. And I think this is quite useful guidance, because although it may not happen too often, I think obviously, you know, mental health is, unfortunately, it's very, you know, it's quite alarming, isn't it? How many people in our generation anyways do suffer, you know, from mental health issues. And there is definitely a stigma around, you know, people and employees and not really knowing what they can and can't share. You know, I think most people would probably assume, no, I can't share that because it's health data. I need the consent of the individual. And obviously it's quite easy for us guys to sit here and say that we know that you don't have to always rely on consent, and obviously consent would not be appropriate. But I think more often than not in organisations, you know, nurses, for example, and people like that would probably think, well, no, I can't do that. I think that would be quite common. So I do think it's really useful, useful guidance, but I kind of just want to unpack it a little bit on here and just have a bit of a conversation. So the guidance states that a mental health emergency or a mental health crisis are more difficult to recognise than a person's physical health emergency. Symptoms of mental health emergencies can vary from person to person, and it can be difficult to judge when a situation becomes an emergency. For the purpose of this guidance, we define a mental health emergency as a situation in which you believe that someone is at risk of serious harm to themselves or others because of their mental health. This could include the potential loss of life. So I'm not going to go into it too much, because obviously it would take quite a bit of time, but I kind of just went, I want to have a look at the lawful basis that they said of which organisations can rely on in order to share this sort of information. And they highlighted two of the Article 6 lawful basis, and those were vital interests. So they said that this may apply where you need to share a worker's health information to protect either their life or someone else's. This is limited in scope and generally only applies in matters of life and death. you cannot use this basis if the worker is capable of giving consent. And then the second potential lawful basis was legitimate interest, and stating that this may apply unless there's a good reason for protecting the worker's personal information, which either outweighs your interests or the interests of a third party. So just going back to the vital interest one, the bit at the end in the guidance where it says that you cannot use this basis if the worker is capable of giving consent, I find that quite contradicting. I don't know what your take on that is. But in my understanding around consent and people who suffer in a mental capacity, I don't necessarily think that you can consider that consent to be, which is probably freely given. I don't think it meets the conditions of consent under Article 7. Definitely not. I don't know what your thoughts on that is.
Yeah, I think so. You can rely on vital interests in a matter of life and death, can't you? And I think that's much more difficult to establish when it relates to mental health rather than physical health. And obviously, you know, as time goes on, there's so much more of a drive for, you know, mental health awareness and so on. So that will only improve. But at the same time, it's one of those. It's like, if you're to rely on vital interest, where can you draw the line? And like you say, when can you establish if someone is capable of giving consent? I don't know what part of what condition specifically you could say, okay, no, it's it doesn't meet this. They can't provide consent. They're not in a fit state to provide consent. But at the same time, it's real life, and it's, you know, that real life application of the GDPR, of the law, to say, no, this is a risky situation. You know, I need to act, essentially.
And that goes back to what Phil said, doesn't it, about, you know, if you're unsure as to whether you can share this information, and you're not sure if the GDPR restricts you from doing so, but it feels right in your gut, then there probably is somewhere in the law that does permit you to do that. So, you know, it absolutely backs Phil's points around that. But I think with vital interests and this specific, the guidance is specific for when it's a mental health emergency, which has been described as a situation in which you believe someone is at risk of serious harm to themselves or others because of their mental health. This can include the potential loss of life. I know it might not always, but I think vital interest would always apply in this instance, in this specific, what they consider to be a mental health emergency. I think vital interest would always apply in this instance. And the bit around consent, I just don't think that's necessary, because I don't think, why would you even consider consent in this instance? If it's a matter of life and death, or, you know, there's going to be some serious harm, there might not be death, but serious harm because of their mental health, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that they're not in a position to provide valid consent.
I think it's more the case of if somebody, you know, struggles with their mental health, but it might be, you know, a less risky situation where, you know, you've not considered this from a data protection standpoint as an organization before, you would look to consent naturally, because, you know, what else can you do? You're not going to go back and undertake a substantial public interest assessment or something like that. You know, consent is sometimes necessary, especially if you know you're about to collect new information on, you know, on site or on the job or whatever. But it would then get to a point where that person is not mentally fit to provide consent, and then it's like, without that, okay, I need to actually share this information regardless.
To be fair, maybe the statement of you cannot use this basis if the worker is capable of giving consent is not saying that you have to rely on consent. It's saying if they're able to probably give consent, then that's when you should probably rely on legitimate interest, because I don't think consent would never run in this situation, would it? Because with consent, you should always outweigh the consequences of the individuals, you know, not providing consent or withdrawing the consent. So say that it wasn't a matter of life and death, and it was, you know, not as severe, and you was to rely on consent, and you asked the individual, can I share your information? Because, like, you know, I think and they say no, you're stuck, aren't you? There's nothing you can do about it. So
maybe
as opposed to saying that you rely on consent, it's saying that if they can give their consent, then you shouldn't rely on bad or interests, and then legitimate interests would be appropriate in that instance.
Well, you still need an Article 9 basis then as well, wouldn't you? So suppose that could be vital interest.
Yeah, the two that they said was vital interest. So similar to the vital interest lawful basis discussed above, this condition may apply in circumstances of life and death. And then the other one would be employment, social security and social protection law. So this is particularly relevant for employers, for example, where you're ensuring the health, safety and welfare of workers. For this to apply, you must identify the legal obligation or right in question.
Mm.
So with that then, why isn't legal obligation considered to be an Article 6 lawful basis? And it's something that I've actually just considered actually since Zara's put it in the chat, you know, legal obligation is an Article 6 lawful basis. And maybe it's because maybe it doesn't specifically state in law that, you know, you can share this sort of information. I don't know what law it would come under, or maybe the employment law, you know, maybe it wouldn't specifically.
Like safeguarding laws, probably.
Yeah, so it might say somewhere that you have like a duty as an employer to safeguard people, but it might not explicitly state around like mental health. So maybe rather than it being a legal obligation, maybe you'd have a legitimate interest to apply to comply with the law as opposed to a specific legal obligation.
But then if you rely on it for Article 9, why can't you rely on it for Article 6? It doesn't really make sense, that.
Yeah, it's a good point.
I'm not questioning.
No, I know
you
you're not. No, you're not. Absolutely. Maybe it's worth reaching out to them and asking them.
Yeah, Zara's put in legal obligation under the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974. So that's one example. There's also, I've seen safeguarding, you know, as an example as well. But Vaughan said, not sure what information we're talking about sharing, though. It must only be limited to what the emergency services need to treat the patient at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So that there is the added pressure of that, isn't there, getting it right of what's, you know, ensuring that you comply with the data minimization principle, that you're using what's adequate to meet the purpose of the processing, which is obviously to safeguard the individuals. So you're right there, Vaughan, that does absolutely added pressure. And I guess it's a case of, you know, planning ahead for these instances as an organization.
Yeah.
And maybe setting out some specific scenarios and examples and the things that you'd probably share. But yeah, it's certainly things that we have to unpick, really. We should unpick this. It's actually quite interesting. It's a shame we haven't got more time, actually. Just looking at the legal obligation lawful basis under Article 6.
Yeah, while you do that.
Have
you got it all?
Process, yeah, it says processing is necessary for compliance with the legal obligation to which the controller is subject. So I don't know why that's not been chosen then.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to ask.
Andy said in the chat, you would need to be able to show someone has capacity. Capacity is difficult to show, and currently only those with medical training, such as doctors, approved mental health practitioners and paramedics, are allowed to decide if an individual has capacity under the Mental Capacity Act, not something you'll be able to show in a workplace. And Hayley said, you would need to consider emergency contacts as well. An individual may not be able, may not want their EC to know about mental health issues. That is a very good point as well. There is further information in that guidance, to be fair, and it does break down about when you should do something, what you could do, including you could inform next of kin. But like you said, Joe, it's making sure that you think these things through before a situation might arise, and that all staff are trained on it and know how to handle these situations. Like you said there, Hayley, if you know someone's next of kin's informed about something and they don't want them to know, it's weighing up the risk, really, isn't it? I suppose it's a high pressure situation.
And it reiterates the point we made earlier on in the podcast around that, you know, you can kind of plan these things out and you can set things in place to try and mitigate risk. But if you don't train your staff to to recognize these things and to understand what they can and can't share, then it kind of just null and voids all of the things that you've put in place. And it's similar to the AI. Do you know, it's, you know, kind of the links I'm trying to draw here kind of links back to the risks around AI biasing and facial recognition and the risks that you might have in place. And, you know, your mitigating steps to reduce those. It's pointless if your staff aren't able to recognize and understand what can and can't be done.
So Janine said, is it not safeguarding of a vulnerable individual? So I don't know if you mean.
I did have that as a thing to kind of say, what about substantial public interest? I completely forgot about that. So thanks, Janine. I did think that I said, why would safeguarding of children and individuals at risk not apply?
I think because it would relate to an individual situation rather than, you know, if you need to collect, say, for example, a housing association needs to collect disability related information, whether you've got a disability or not, to be able to put measures in place, you could probably rely on that more. So there might be another basis that's more suitable for that, like social protection law or something. I'm not sure. But it's more on an individual level, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they've probably not said that because the other two are cleaner to apply to the processing as opposed to the substantial public interest assessment. I think that's probably the reason why they've not left that, not included that as a potential lawful basis, because I think the vital interest one and the employment law basis would be a lot easier to apply. So they've probably just thought, you know, maybe why go above and beyond when there's two more obvious ones.
Well, I think we should probably leave it there. There's a lot of questions
absolutely.
About it. It's definitely provided food for thought, because it's not a simple concept, and you know, you can do all you can to prepare for that kind of situation. But this highlights that it's very much context dependent, and just by putting as many measures in place as possible beforehand, you know, will help in those situations as much as possible. But even still, you know, if you've got any more questions off the back of that, please bring them up in the next episode and we'll look further into them. But for the time being, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be
back
next week with our first guest speaker in ages, actually. Rebecca, have I just left the thing? Oh,
no, yeah.
I heard a little boop. Rebecca Ballybacko, who will be talking to us about about engineering and how that interplays with data protection. So it'll be really interesting, really fresh perspective on data protection, because you know, we have a lot of episodes, we've got to the point now where there's a lot of similar episodes, and this is something completely different, and it's how data protection can integrate with other areas of the organization and really get stuck into the the beginning of a new project and those kinds of things. So we're really looking forward to it anyway, and she will be able to shed a lot more light than myself. But in the meantime, have a great weekend, and thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
See you later. Bye.